This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is September 28th, 2009. This is the second session with Emeritus Professor Anatole Beck of Mathematics. So Anatole, we wanted to pick it up today with your moving into a role as a campus activist in the Faculty Senate based on what you saw in 1968 at the Commerce Building and your reaction to what Chancellor Sewell said about it.
Yes, and I was saying that the Chancellor had not been in any way a witness to what went on. And I was told by others, whose veracity I have no way of remembering or proving, that the Dean of Students, one Joseph Kaufman, had been very active in sort of reading the Riot Act to Sewell and telling him he must do this or that. I thought it was rather odd that the Dean of Students should have that much authority with the Chancellor, but, you know, the Chancellor can take his advice where he finds it, except that I never thought of Sewell, whose sons I had taught, by the way, as being out of the same box as Joe Kaufman. And it was later told to me that Joe Kaufman, before coming to the University of Wisconsin, had been in the intelligence business in Moscow on behalf of the United States, so apparently had some federal authority, which I knew nothing about and which I know nothing about even now. At any rate, that's what it was, and when the people who were interested in that were trying to separate Chancellor Sewell, whom we admired, from the decision which we thought was grossly mistaken. We tried through a good part of the evening session of that meeting to separate those two issues.
This is the meeting in the Union Theater?
The meeting in the Union Theater. And every move that was made had been ruled out of order by the Vice Chancellor, whose name I do not remember, actually. It's a long time ago, like 40 years ago.
Yes, indeed, 41 years ago.
Right. And but I did get the floor, and I talked about that this is what we had been attempting to do. Everything we had moved had been ruled out of order, ruled out of order, ruled out of order. We could not put anything on the floor. And I said that the administration, through misuse of the power of the chair, had prevented us from putting this on the floor. And then, quite surprising to me, I heard this immense roar, because it turns out that the students were listening to these proceedings out on the terrace, which were being piped out to them.
Was this a meeting of the Faculty Senate?
There was no Faculty Senate yet.
Okay.
And this was just a this was the faculty. That's all we had at the time.
Oh, the faculty as a whole.
Which meant that every month, exactly as the Senate does now. But there was a certain amount of self-selection of faculty for attending these conferences, these meetings. I was thinking of the meeting in which the School of Agriculture renamed themselves as the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. This brought expressions of outrage from the medical school.
Oh.
But the difference was that to the agriculture school, it was very important. And a lot of them, they were there. And the medical school, only those people who were interested in the politics of the university were there. Mm-hmm. And people began to have this feeling about self-selected senators. And as the years went by, and there was more and more action in the faculty meeting by the opponents of the war and similarly attached efforts, mm-hmm. like the Army Center, mm-hmm. which had the unfortunate situation of being present on the campus so that students who wanted to carry out a protest against the war or against the federal government didn't have to go to Washington to do it. Mm-hmm. The Army Center had a big seal on the outside, sort of advertising the fact that it was the United States Army. And those people who were inclined to be very obstreperous took that as a target, eventually coming down to the bombing, which was so outrageous and so terrible. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was there. And when it was gone, they did the same thing with ROTC. Mm-hmm. Not because they hated the officer corps, or even, as they said, because they were worried about the gays, mm-hmm. but because these were people who were facing the draft to go and fight a war they didn't believe in and be killed in the jungles of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And their only way of expressing themselves to the federal government without leaving Madison was to find a federal target. Mm-hmm. There were places where they found other federal targets, I think, like the post office, mm-hmm. or something. But that wasn't my piece of work. Mm-hmm. That wasn't my piece of work. But I think that the roar from the students, first of all, scared the faculty. Because disorder is not something that anybody wanted on the campus.
And this is in the spring of 68?
I think it was 67, actually.
Oh, I see.
I believe. My memory is not accurate on this, and I have not refreshed it by chasing down the documents. I believe it was 67. Mm-hmm. I believe it was the same year that my mother died.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But my mother died in the spring, and this was the fall.
Oh, this is the fall of 67.
Fall of 67. The reason I think it was that is that one of the really unfortunate results, I thought, was that the sociology department had entered a nomination to the Committee on Honorary Degrees to confer an honorary doctorate upon Dr. Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. And I do remember that I attempted to get a seconding of that nomination in the math department, but that one of my colleagues, for instance, who was a man of very liberal outlook, felt that it would be singularly inappropriate for a math department to be seconding to such a nomination, and his point of view did carry. Hmm. And I saw a lot of justice in that. On the other hand, it is a general choice made by the whole faculty at that time. Hmm. The interesting thing is that the nomination just disappeared, hmm. so that by the time when the vote was taken in December, only a few people knew that it was missing. And there was no way of acting. And within a few months, of course, King had been assassinated. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, prior to that, he had partaken in protests in Milwaukee, which a lot of people in Madison quite rightly feared would spread to the university. Mm-hmm. Not because they were wrong, but because they simply did not want the trouble, because by that time, Berkeley was having lots of trouble, mm-hmm. even more than Madison. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want any of that. Mm-hmm. So and I became somehow, I think, in the minds of some of the faculty, tainted with that problem.
Which problem?
The problem of bringing destructive protests to campus.
I see.
After years, I thought back on the situation in Commerce, and I realized that a subtle attitude, if they had said to the Dow interviewers, instead of saying to the protesters, "You have no right to do this, we were going to kick you until you stop doing it," and in fact putting the whole Commerce building out of use for months because it was tainted with CS gas. Mm-hmm. If they had said to Dow, "Get a room in the hotel and just be here every day for interviewing until the protests stop." Mm-hmm. You know, somebody as wise as the previous chancellor, I forgot his name, he went on to be president of the University of Michigan.
Fleming.
Fleming probably would have said that, and he in 2 or 3 days, the people who were protesting would be tired of doing it and would go back to their classes, and Dow would have interviewed the people they wanted to interview, and the situation would have simply simmered down. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's true, but it only occurred to me much later on. Mm-hmm. The whole thing was so confrontational, mm-hmm. and confrontationality was the character of it. I mean, people came out to a protest who, I don't know who they were, but I was there and I saw the way the thing went. It went very peculiarly. I'll tell you what I told the conference. This is what I saw. The police came into the Commerce building and started to push at the eastern end of the building at the crowd. The idea being that if you push hard enough at the 100 or so students at the eastern end, the students at the western end would all run away out the back door. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen. What happened was that the students pushed back, and they actually pushed the police to the door. And then I heard glass breaking. I did not see who broke the glass or how. Mm-hmm. But I heard glass, I knew that the front door had been broken. And then the police came charging back in and just beating everybody inside. Mm-hmm. It was very brutal. Mm-hmm. I was fortunately removed from it by half a flight of stairs. Mm-hmm. I was standing on the landing above that. Mm-hmm. So I had a very good view of it. And I told the faculty what I saw. And there were people who suspected me of I don't know what. Mm-hmm. But it was so confrontational, so divided. And I think it still is.
Anatole, did you have a reputation before this event of an agent provocateur?
No.
You were just regarded as a fine professor of mathematics.
I don't know about fine, but it's just a professor of mathematics. As I told you, I had made my mother had made a deal with me, mm-hmm. which I'll tell you about later because it's before I came to Wisconsin, mm-hmm. that I had to keep my nose clean and my mind to the student, on my studies. Mm-hmm. And she would make up for that by being the activist in the family. Mm-hmm. And as I said to you, in a way that I can only describe as being either juvenile or adolescent, I agreed to that. Mm-hmm. Because I also wanted to be a mathematician. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to be a professor. Mm-hmm. The world was not letting me alone. Mm-hmm. But then when she died in the spring of 1967, not too late after that, I suddenly realized I was the head of the family. Mm-hmm. It was just me and my wife and my children and my brother, mm-hmm. who was 8 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I could no longer take this deal that I made with my mother as cover for my doing nothing when I saw things happening that I thought were bad. Mm-hmm. Or which needed attention. Mm-hmm. So that was when, by that September, this situation with Dow Chemical came up. And if there had been trouble before, and in the earlier trouble, there were the reports of the students and the reports of the police. They were very different. Mm-hmm. I thought, being quite naive, that if professors were there keeping witness, that would make a difference. Mm-hmm. And I recruited people to come and be at the Cummers building if they had a free hour. Mm-hmm. And it happened that the free hour for me came when the trouble started. Mm-hmm. And so therefore I felt I had the obligation to speak the truth, mm-hmm. as I knew it. That's all I did.
Were you surprised by the strength of the reaction from faculty against you?
The answer is yes, I was. And as I look back now, I shouldn't have been. I mean, when the faculty lived a very comfortable life, very settled life, in which they still at that point were imagining that this was a self-governing faculty. Mm-hmm. It was advertised that way throughout the academic world, and it was very, people were constantly, the university committee was constantly being referred to in the public press with the adjective powerful. By the time I got onto the university committee, it was not powerful, it was not as powerless as it is today. Mm-hmm. So things have changed in this school, as it have changed in America, the academe. Mm-hmm. So I was surprised. As I said, I didn't think that I had come there to make trouble. Mm-hmm. I thought I had come there to tell people what I had seen, because I'm a professor, you're a professor, you should, there's nothing wrong with the chancellor, but he is only telling you what he's been told. Mm-hmm. That's what I went there to tell them. I still think the same thing about that, mm-hmm. only I'm no longer surprised at the virulence of the reaction. Mm-hmm. But I've had a lot of training since then.
Yes, that's one of the reasons we're interviewing you.
Right. And but for instance, all I did, I took part in relatively few protests. I actually did more protesting at the urging of my children, who had taken a lot of this on. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is, there is a film about the protests in Madison. Mm-hmm. I don't appear anywhere in the film. Mm-hmm. Nobody mentions my name. Nobody talks to me. Nobody asks me anything. Mm-hmm. I was a minor figure. Mm-hmm. The one thing I could do was the one thing that I volunteered for, which was to go to gatherings of people who would be brought together by activists. Mm-hmm. And I was willing to go and tell them, why I thought they should think, as I did, that the war in Vietnam was hopeless, mm-hmm. and that it was only a question of how many people would be killed on both sides before that unpleasant realization sunk through to the American government, very much like it is today in Afghanistan. So that I'm planning to say on the radio this week. Do you know that I have a radio show?
No, I didn't know that. On WORT?
Yeah, it's not much of a show. It's 2 minutes a week, repeated four times a week. Oh. If you want, I'll send you my scripts.
Yeah, do that.
Okay, I'll do that. I'll add your name to my list.
Okay.
But the one thing I could do was talk to people. Mm-hmm. And I explained to them, regardless of what you would want to see in Vietnam, that there was no choice available. The choice was that we could continue to fight until we finally recognized that we were fighting a losing battle, mm-hmm. as the French had found. Mm-hmm. And eventually that's what happened. So. You know, I don't say that the fact that it happened that way proves that I was right. Mm-hmm. But I think I was right. Mm-hmm. You know, that eventually you cannot fight a nationalist movement which has the support of the people. Mm-hmm. Even the unwilling support of the people. Mm-hmm. You know, because they look on your troops as occupiers and as attackers.
Anatole, after you spoke at that faculty meeting, did you pursue this within your department? Did you have math colleagues who engaged you on this, or?
Well, it's interesting that you should ask me that, because I remember being approached by a colleague to sign a letter. And I looked at the letter. I agreed with it, sort of, not virulently. But there were four people who were signing it. And I looked at it. I did not want to leave them out there alone. Mm-hmm. And although I was not a firebrand, mm-hmm. I basically agreed with what they were saying. I was not the one circulating the letter.
Was this about the war?
I think it was about the war. I don't even remember. Mm-hmm. It might have been about the war, or it might have been about the war removed one state, like, for instance, the attack on ROTC. Mm-hmm. I think it may have been that, mm-hmm. but I'm not sure. But I remember who the other four were. I'm not going to say who they were. Mm-hmm. But everybody who needs to know knows. And...
These were all colleagues in math.
These were all members of the math department, yeah. But I was not a firebrand, and I'm still not a firebrand, mm-hmm. although people think I am, mm-hmm. because we live in a world in which the norm is silent submission.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I wasn't that. Mm-hmm. I was... The one outrageous thing I was willing to do was speak the truth as I knew it. Mm-hmm. And you know, there is a Protestant phrase of speak the truth and shame the devil. Mm-hmm. I've never figured out what shame the devil means. The point is, speaking the truth, I think, is an important thing, mm-hmm. because having a docile population is the sort of thing that leads to revolutions. Mm-hmm. And I had been worrying about revolutions for many years, even when I was in college, because I was faced with an interesting anomaly. I knew that a society in which a revolution was impossible becomes increasingly intolerable. Mm-hmm. People become hubristic. Mm-hmm. The other side of that is I didn't want to live through a revolution. I didn't want my children or my grandchildren to live through a revolution. I had seen what happened to a revolution in Russia, mm-hmm. which I'll tell you about later. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want any of that. On the other hand, if you get to the situation as they did in the old regime in France, mm-hmm. when it was believed by the people who made the laws that the common people had no choice but to obey in silence, and the same was true in Russia. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that there were two revolutions in Russia. There was the February Revolution and the October Revolution.
Correct.
The February Revolution wasn't really had no revolutionaries involved.
Mm-hmm. That was Kerensky.
It wasn't Kerensky.
I thought it was Kerensky.
It was before Kerensky. What happened was that a crowd of peasants had come to the Winter Palace to beg the Tsar for bread because they were starving. And somebody in the army had ordered the Cossacks to attack them and cut them down or drive them out. And the Cossacks refused. And when the Cossacks refused to do that, the monarchy was over. Mm-hmm. They fled for their lives and were pursued. Mm-hmm. And so that was it. And of course, Wilson thought finally that there was going to be a democratic government in Russia. Okay? But Kerensky was insistent on continuing the war. Mm-hmm. And Lenin took that as his wedge for power. Mm-hmm. And essentially, the army deserted. Mm-hmm. And Lenin said of that desertion, they said, well, how do the soldiers, this is not verbatim, do this? He said that they voted against the war. They voted against it. How do you vote against the war? He said, with their feet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember.
I mean, that's a very tart piece of history. Mm-hmm. But he did. And people who had been sent into battle carrying broomsticks because there weren't enough rifles, they simply went home. Mm-hmm. And the communists, of course, to the extent that they were there and being activists, encouraged that. And suddenly people, they swarmed onto trains and they went home. Mm-hmm. And Russia was out of the war. And of course, the Western powers were devastated because they were counting on the Russians to nail down the Germans in the East. Mm-hmm. Of course, I didn't know any of this until much later in my life. But I knew that when we arrived in Moscow in 1932, my mother took one look at it, decided we've got to get out of here as soon as possible. But I'll tell you that story later. I mean, but that is, so I knew that I did not want to live through a revolution. Mm-hmm. The revolution at the Winter Palace was like the revolution at the Bastille, where there were also no revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. It was simply an expression of huge, what's the word I want? I'm having trouble with words now. When you can't do what you want to do.
Frustration,
of huge frustration. When in a situation where people were told, you have no choice. You simply have to do it. The law says you have to pay the taxes and keep your mouth shut. So I knew I didn't want that part of my life. Mm-hmm. I had seen the lives of people destroyed in Russia and later on in China.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I was not a revolutionary. but I also had this piece of intellectual intelligence that said, when it's understood that revolutions are impossible, things just get worse. People who think that they are having it good want it to be even better. And I would point to the healthcare racket, as I call it.
Today,
as an example. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not believable to me that the healthcare racket could produce a revolution in the United States. Because, among other things, unlike Russia and unlike France and the Ancien Regime, people can vote if they choose to. Mm-hmm. The surprising thing is they don't choose to.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But voting is making a revolution without a gun.
Yes, I like that. And it's true, actually.
Yeah. So I had this anomaly in my thinking. Mm-hmm. And the thing that just absolutely swept me away was a speech in the play Marasad. I couldn't understand why revolutions always fail, but they always fail. Mm-hmm. And he said, now, as I saw it, it was in the mouth of Desaad, but I think it was originally written in the mouth of Marat. Mm-hmm. And he said, everybody wants to bring something with him through the revolution. This man wants his library. That man wants his house. Another wants his job. Another wants his factory. This man wants his army, and that man wants his king. He described it. He said, everybody wants to bring something with them through the revolution, a souvenir of the old regime, he said. And I said, that's right. Everybody is against the same thing, but they're not all for the same thing.
Yes, absolutely.
And so that changed my whole view on revolution. Okay? That a revolution can only succeed if everybody wants the same thing, or a very large proportion of them want the same thing. It's certainly not clear that that was true in France, and it's not clear that that was true in Russia. Mm-hmm. Or in China. So, revolution, I'm not a revolutionary.
But you were perceived as such by your colleagues.
No doubt.
Because, by and large, I'm
because
assuming.
I was making a revolution in their world, mm-hmm. which was my world.
Did you ever talk in these philosophical terms to the Senate? Or not the Senate, but faculty gathered before the Senate?
Well, yes, I have, but not to this depth. Mm-hmm. But in 1972, mm-hmm. I won election to the university committee. And I sat with the university committee. All the other five people were much more conservative than me. I mean, when I sat with the university committee, I was president of the Local 223 of the American Federation of Teachers here on the campus. I was vice president of the. I wasn't yet vice president of the WFT, but I was president of the union, and a member of the AAUP. And at one point, when we were discussing unions, I said that I'm here to speak on behalf of the AAUP, which would be very good, and or of the union, which would be even better. I did not attack the AAUP. I thought it would be good for them to be the union. I thought that the union would be a better union. And throughout that, I limited, for instance, a lot of my activism on the university committee to opposition to merger, which I saw as being very destructive. I knew that I did not want to be in the same pot with the state teachers' colleges because I had seen, for instance, the case of Roth v. Regents. I don't know if you were aware of that.
Of which?
Roth against Regents.
No.
Roth was an assistant professor of political science at Oshkosh. And Oshkosh was having trouble with the Negro population that they had imported, previously having been lily white.
Mm-hmm.
And there were protests, and the president, as he was known then, the president of Oshkosh, took some extreme action. I think he expelled the whole group of black students.
Mm-hmm.
And Roth said publicly at a meeting that he thought that that was a very foolish thing for the president to do. He may even have said stupid for all I know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear him. Point is, he had already been told that he was being reappointed for the next year.
Mm-hmm.
Because the rules of tenure at Oshkosh were, in your fourth year, you attain tenure. So there was a three-year trial period. So he had already been told that he would have a second year, and then he was told that he would not have a second year.
Mm. After he made the statement about
right.
the president.
Yeah, what the president did was not the thing to do. Was a stupid or foolish, maybe even idiotic. I don't know what he said.
Mm-hmm.
Case went to federal court, and Jim Doyle, the real Jim Doyle, not this one,
mm-hmm.
said, well, the position of the regents were that they could refuse him a renewal of his position for any reason or for no reason. And they have held to that position to this day. And Doyle said, it's true that they could deny reappointment to a non-tenured faculty member for any reason or for no reason, but not for an illegal reason.
Hmm.
And that if they had violated Roth's free speech rights, that's an illegal reason, which I thought was an excellent decision. And then he said something which was finally overturned by the Rehnquist, the Rehnquist Court.
Mm-hmm. Oh, at the Supreme Court level.
Supreme Court level. They said, because what he said was, when the circumstances were as they were in the Roth case, of suspicion of that the reason for his being denied after having been accepted was that he had spoken ill of the president, that the administration has the responsibility to tell him why he wasn't being appointed, and that the statement that they made had to be true. Okay? And the Rehnquist Court said, no, that he doesn't, they don't have to tell him why he was denied reappointment. He has to prove it himself.
Hmm.
Which I thought was, you know, I thought Doyle was absolutely right
mm-hmm.
on that case.
Mm-hmm.
So then Roth went to court and convinced the jury he was right. Okay, and what he got for that was a year's pay, because in the meantime, he had been hired by Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
And as between Purdue and Oshkosh, you know, there are very few people who would choose Oshkosh.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this whole Roth case influenced your activity on the university
absolutely.
Committee against merger that
against
Governor
merger.
Lucy was proposing.
Right. Actually, that Governor Lucy's friend, David,
Adam Annie?
Adam Annie, had brought to him. I don't think Lucy had any idea what was going on in the university. I mean, he was a businessman, and he saw the university as a business. Mm-hmm. But Adam Maney came to him having been dean of students at Wesleyan. Mm-hmm. You know, so he's somebody, and also a family friend. Okay? And he suggested merger. Now, I will tell you that when he became president of Wayne State, he was dead set against merger in Michigan.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you know Adam Maney yourself?
I actually met him a couple of times because he lived three houses down the street from me.
Oh.
I actually thought him a very interesting and pleasant character, except for his policies. Mm-hmm. But he was famous at Wayne for being a union buster. Mm-hmm. And then he was hired at Temple to bust the union there.
Oh, I didn't remember he'd gone to Temple from Wayne State.
Yeah, well, not directly. He had retired from Wayne State and was sort of president emeritus there. And then a couple of years later, he was hired at Temple when they were having trouble with their union. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what finally happened to him because all my information about him comes through a very close friend of mine who teaches at Wayne State. Mm-hmm. But he was brutal in his evaluation of Adam Maney when he was president. So anyhow, that's what we had. So we had merger, and I was fighting, talk about conservatism. I was fighting inside the university committee for establishing that there were two units in the system. There were two units in the system of approximately the same size. Mm. One was Madison and Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And the other is everybody else. Mm-hmm. That's what I was there for. Mm-hmm. And I wanted that the Madison and Milwaukee University committees should represent the doctoral faculty, separate from the faculties of the other schools who would have their own thing. So here I was defending the ancien regime.
Yeah, the status quo.
Right.
And were you alone in that position on the university committee at that time?
Well, people sort of sympathized with it, but they were people who were following the old rule of we aren't going to win this, we shouldn't fight it. As they were later on when the I don't know if you remember that the regents essentially said that tenure is only good for 5 years.
I do remember that.
Okay. And my colleague in mathematics, who was chairman of the university committee, said, they have the power. There's no point in fighting them. Now, my idea, as I said, always was speak the truth, take your position, be dignified enough to lose. And I've always had that position. Honor your own beliefs. Mm-hmm. So in this particular case, my beliefs were very conservative.
Yes. And did the faculty position on merger go to the whole faculty for a vote?
No, the opposition was sort of a disjointed opposition. I mean, we were against it. We were all against it. Mm-hmm. But I was the only activist.
That's so interesting. That's really very interesting to me, because it was very clear, at least at the time, that UW-Madison would lose under merger.
Well, and furthermore, we would lose more definitely, I felt, if we stood alone. But since we were already meeting every month with the university committee from Milwaukee, mm-hmm. I said, we should consider that we are these 12 people representing the doctoral campuses, doctoral faculty, and one apiece from the other campuses is another 12 or 13.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That didn't happen. Now there is a weekly meeting of the faculties, and there's one member from Madison, and one member from Milwaukee, and one member from Whitewater, and one member from Stevens Point, etc. That's what I didn't want to see happen.
Mm-hmm.
Some people might call that democracy. I didn't see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I saw not democracy, I saw the mission of the knowledge business. I urge you to read that thing. It will tell you a lot about me. Mm-hmm. By the way,
Is this the missing chapter?
Missing chapter. So, thank you. And this...
Thank you.
This missing chapter, years later, when the pensions problem was big news, I came to the realization that there was something very serious at the root of this chapter and of the pensions problem. And what was serious was that we had a vast labor surplus, and we were dealing with it badly. We were dealing with it in a way which some people thought was their advantage, because they could use the surplus of labor to break the unions and reduce wages and benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And that has happened. But they would present that as natural law.
Mm-hmm.
And my colleagues at the LSE were also saying it. I said, what's the matter? You call yourself scientists, and you do not penetrate down to the bottom.
And what is LSE?
Oh, London School of Economics.
Oh, right. Okay.
I said, you know, and I realized at some point, I was thinking like a mathematician, though there's no mathematics in there other than sheer grade school arithmetic.
Mm-hmm.
But I say it makes more sense to share the available jobs than to let people fight for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And there are principles underlying that. And one of the principles is something called the Iron Law of Wages, which I learned about in college.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew it. Every economist knows about it.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a word said about that problem in any discussion of the pensions problem. That because we have more people who want to work, I realized that in 1938, you know, the Wages and Hours Act reduced the standard work week from 48 hours to 40.
Mm-hmm.
You know that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I said, but 1938 is a long way behind this. And we are now much more efficient in our work, immeasurably more efficient, and much more capable of working in older age.
Mm-hmm.
So we should be working more years and fewer hours a week. Even if we do spend the same 90,000 hours in a lifetime working. But when I started to look at that, I realized couldn't do that. You couldn't do that because if you shortened the work week, you would increase the supply of labor.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would shorten the work week more and you would increase the supply of labor more, etc. But there's a limit to that. There's a natural limit. And it was in my thinking, and none of this is on the basis of knowledge of people's work habits.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there was a natural threshold in that package, when you could get people down to the time when they're working 3 8-hour days a week, and you have more couples in which the husband works and the wife works and there's always somebody at home, and that would change our world. And I started writing the manuscript, which you have as A Better Life. And as you can see on the last pages of the draft that I sent you, I was writing in fear of the collapse of the economy. Okay, and then it collapsed.
Right.
And then I figured, oh, I have to go back and start this all over again. And I haven't done it because there are mathematical things. I have a paradox, a wonderful paradox, which in my folly, I want to have that work finished so it could be my monument.
I suppose you saw the article in the New York Times yesterday that there are 6 applicants for every job available.
Well, and I saw the current issue of Time magazine, which deals with, you know, how many jobless there are. And one of the things I had discovered before I started writing, how many people who are involuntarily jobless are not called unemployed.
So if you count them, unemployment is up around
12-15%. Or more than that.
Is it higher than that?
The biggest group that isn't counted, interestingly enough, is women. The women's movement in the 60s told women they shouldn't just be chained to the kitchen, they should go out and work. What they discovered was even those who had been to college found it very hard to find a job that would pay for their child care and the cost of commuting, etc., and the taxes that went along with it, and would leave them with almost nothing, or maybe even less than nothing. You know, if I got a job as a receptionist, I'm not talking about somebody who was going to be a divorce lawyer. I'm talking about somebody, lots of college-educated women might get to be stenos, okay? If you have to pay a fully qualified carer, okay? And the carer has to work more hours a week than the parent, because the parent has to bring the child and go collect the child, okay? And the parent has to pay income tax, and the carer has to pay income tax.
Right.
So if you stay home and take care of your own child, it looks like a better deal, unless you can't stand it, as some people can't. And I came to the conclusion, if we could reach 24 hours a week for 60 years, instead of 40 hours a week for 45 years, it would be wonderful. It's only a decrease of 20% in the number of hours, and there's that much labor available in the job corps now of the people who want a job, including those who are not counted as unemployed. That was my figuring. And I said we can learn about it by experiment. The first thing we can do is drop the work week from 40 hours to 36 hours, being 4 9-hour days, or even 4 10-hour days, but 10 hours is a pretty long day. I think if you had 4 10-hour days, pretty soon you'd have 4 9-hour days, because there are all these people who want jobs, and you've already made the job better. If you have 4 10-hour days, so you've got another day you don't have to commute, and you can go to the doctor during business hours, or the dentist, or et cetera, et cetera. there would be more people, not many more, but there would be more people available for work at 4 10-hour days. And if you were interested in reducing the disruption, you'd pretty soon get to 4 9-hour days, because people working fewer days are more productive. As I discovered, for reasons which are in the manuscript. Mm-hmm. Namely, in 1973, when I was a professor at the London School of Economics, and there was the oil shortage, they ran the factories 3 days a week to conserve on oil, on heating. And instead of having a 40% loss of product, they had only a 20% loss of product. I said, there's something to be learned there. Shorter work week gets you more product per hour. And later on, I read something in the newspaper about when France decreed a 35-hour week, there was a woman in the Jura who said that she would pay her workers 40 hours for 35 hours if they would agree to do their work on a two-shift basis where they did their share of the 35 hours in 3 days. And she would have two of them and run her factory 6 days a week. And what was reported in the papers, and I didn't get the full, I didn't write down the citation, was that her costs increased by 10%, but her product increased by 30%.
Mm-hmm. Her profit?
Her output increased by 30%. She had to hire 10% more workers. But, and then I looked into it. It has always been known that every time we've shortened the work week, labor becomes more productive.
Anatole, did you have these kinds of discussions with members of the economics department here on campus?
No, not here. I tried to get the attention of a particular economist at LSE, two economists. One was somebody that I knew from the time, this was recently, this was not when I was professor. I didn't have these ideas when I was professor. This was recently, so I was already back here. But I was visiting frequently at the LSE. One of my, both of the people that I'm talking about were members of the House of Lords, actually. One of them, Richard Layard, was famous for his extolling of the importance of leisure. So I thought he would be very happy with what I was saying. And he said no, he was against it because it would impinge on the possibility of having more product. I could not get him to believe that the limiting factor on how much product there was not how many people were willing to work, but how many people were willing to employ them. That is, if we had, as I said in my experiment, the limiting factor is how many jobs there are. As long as there are people very eager for jobs, people whom, if you ask them, do you want to work if it's available, they would say yes. And for instance, I picked up an article in, of all places, Fortune magazine, called Down and Out in Blue Collar America, which talking about the fact that people in advanced professions like accounting were finding themselves involuntarily jobless in their late 40s or early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And except for the few who have made it into management, into top management, the people who were in top management found that it was cheaper and more useful to let people go if they weren't at that level, and to hire new university graduates. And that's happening. And then they work their asses off. Mm-hmm. They work them 80 hours a week for mm-hmm. 20 years, and then they let them go.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, that's not a way to people who can do long division should not be thinking that that's the only way of doing things.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And those people do not count themselves as unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
They go in various places. Some of them are unemployed. Some of them, when they're up against the wall, will take a job stacking the shelves at Walmart's.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will try to be consultants, though very few of them make much of a living at it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will call themselves early retirees.
Mm-hmm.
They would rather be retired than unemployed. Something degrading about being unemployed.
Correct.
And these are people with knowledge. It's not the case that the people coming out of university know a great deal more. They don't. They may know a few things more, but if they don't know this, they don't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. This is most engaging, insightful. But again, I ask you, did you ever talk this way at faculty meetings?
No. I spoke to Richard Layard. I could just barely get to see him.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another lord there, Meghnad Desai, born in Bombay and a professor at the London School of Economics.
Mm-hmm.
By now retired. By now they're both retired.
Mm-hmm.
And Layard I didn't know, but Desai was a friend of mine from the days when I was a professor there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I spoke to them about it. You know, what I wanted was to get the book published,
mm-hmm.
or the paper published.
Mm. Of course.
Yeah, but I haven't been able to do that because I haven't finished the paper yet.
Mm-hmm.
The earlier paper was only about 12 pages.
Oh.
Okay, and this paper is in the second draft where I gave it up.
Mm-hmm.
It's about half finished and it's 52 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
And it might even be bigger than 100 pages, but it might be a small book instead of being a long paper. But I suddenly found myself running short of time. I'll be 80 in less than a half year.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have the same energy that you had when you were 40.
Well, more than that, I just don't have the time. I don't know how long I'll last.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my father died when he was 46,
mm-hmm.
suddenly of a heart attack, but that was true of a lot of people who were immigrants from Europe after the First World War, working in the sweatshops of New York.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people in my neighborhood who died in their late 30s and early 40s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I never expected to reach 70, much less 80.
Well, you seem quite vigorous to me.
I feel vigorous, and I write about that. I say, except for strenuous physical labor,
mm-hmm.
I can work till I'm 80.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who works at an office can work till he's 80. And if in addition, what he gets for that is 4-day weekends starting when he's 25. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. When he can do things when he's young and strong.
Yeah.
Instead of coming up, running into a wall at 65 and terrible reports of how many people find themselves lost. When they don't have a job, I'm afraid of that.
Mm-hmm.
When I don't have a job, so the shape of my life is at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't been successful at getting my stuff published. So I can't say, well, okay, I'll just spend my time writing these things that I think about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a very poor salesman.
Uh-huh.
But I look at these things the way a mathematician does. If I can prove it, I believe it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to return to some of the issues that you dealt with as an advocate for truth in the faculty.
Right.
Were you engaged in the late 60s, early 70s in an effort at that time to expel ROTC from campus?
Only, how to put it, casually.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I came out for the faculty meeting when that was the issue, and I voted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the great thing about voting, as I said, it's a revolution without a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And the ROTC came out, all of them, they were all there. It was like the story between ag and medical.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, everybody else, some came, some didn't. But the ROTC, they were all there. I will bet, if I don't know for a fact, I will bet that they were all under orders to be there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And I don't even remember how that vote went.
Well, it must have lost because ROTC is still on campus.
I think, yeah, that's true. I guess it did lose, but not by much.
Oh, it was a close vote, was it?
I think so, yeah.
Now, you were elected to the university committee in 1972.
Right.
That's an honor of sorts, because you have to run from the whole campus, do you not?
Right. And I'll confess something to you. I like to talk about my having been on the university committee. I don't talk about the fact that I saw being on the university committee as something I wanted to do, and I saw a chance to do it. I saw a chance to do it because there were a lot of nominations from the floor in 1972. And I saw the chance, and I had circulated a petition which only required the signatures of 5 professors to nominate me.
Uh-huh.
And I was on the ballot, and I was popular enough that there were two people not elected each year, and I got the second plurality.
Hmm.
So I can't say that my being on the university committee was an affirmation that I got a majority of the faculty.
Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, you represented a significant number.
So certainly significant. And I beat out a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Just barely enough.
What do they say in politics? You know, a margin of one, you win by an inch or win by
right.
a mile
well,
or whatever, but you win.
That was my attitude. And I wanted to be on the university committee because I wanted to do good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened was, in the winter of 72, I went to London and I stayed with one of my colleagues for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I met another colleague who was an old friend from Warwick.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, You know, the position at LSE has been advertised. I've told you this, haven't I? Maybe not. Position at LSE has been advertised. And my attitude was, this is the best job in the world for me.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you did talk about that.
Yeah.
And you took it for a year.
2 years.
2 years. But then it wasn't possible for you and your family to stay.
Right, it couldn't. And I just was disposing of old income taxes, and I was looking at my pay slip from my time at London. And while I was being paid as a full professor and head of the department, or head of my research group, mm-hmm. I was being paid £7,575 a year.
Mm-hmm. And that's at about $2.50
something like
to a
that.
Pound.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't. And the prices in London were about a pound to the dollar, mm-hmm. compared with ours.
Yeah.
But I wanted to do that. I did not want to pass that up without having tried it.
And so one of the results of that was that you were then not active with the university committee.
Right. I had to resign from the university committee.
So you were only on the committee?
I was only on the for a year and 2 summers. Mm-hmm. But the other fact was that when the possibilities came along, I realized that my marriage was extremely unsatisfactory. Mm-hmm. My wife actually was beginning to recognize that she was a lesbian. She was all over the board. It didn't matter. I was not going to sacrifice my chance to try the best job in the world to save that marriage. Mm-hmm. And I told her I was leaving. Mm-hmm. I never moved for divorce. She moved for divorce. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a question of strategy. Mm-hmm. But so I went and I took my son with me. Mm-hmm. Because he was, at that point, he was 13. Mm-hmm. And I wanted him to grow up in the home of a man. Mm-hmm. My daughter was already living out of the family, in the student slums, and eventually, surprisingly, she got into the university in 1973.
This university?
This university, without ever having really been to high school. Hmm. But she had been in various places where she had done various kind of, in the meantime, in order to work as a waitress at Union South, she had registered for some courses in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Well, she had spoken Hebrew when I spent a year in Jerusalem, mm-hmm. in 64, 65. So it came back to her and so on. She did quite well. So she came along, and the university was in real trouble that year, because they had passed a limitation on how many out-of-staters could be enrolled. Mm-hmm. And that
had come from the legislature.
That had come from the legislature. Mm-hmm. But the point is, the reception of that among Jewish circles in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles was devastating. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that by September of that year, already by summer of that year, it was known that the enrollment would be short by 2,000, mm-hmm. compared with what they had expected. Mm-hmm. And they were desperate for students, and she went in and essentially showed her B average and said, here's my proof that I can do college work. Mm-hmm. And they took her.
Interesting.
Which is wonderful, because, you know, she had gotten caught up in this free school movement.
Oh, sure. So once you return to campus from the London School of Economics,
right,
and still focused on your role as a speaker of the truth, what are some of the other issues you're addressing the faculty?
First of all, one of the first things that happened was some friends of mine that October, some friends of mine who were in the Wisconsin Federation of Teachers urged me to run for the executive board of the Wisconsin Federation of Teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I had been president of the local here, and so I took that up, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was in a part of what I was learning and so on. But here on campus, I more or less let things come to me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go looking for anything.
Mm-hmm.
But for instance, when the issue came up of 5-year tenure,
mm-hmm,
I fought that as hard as I could.
And successfully, did you not?
No. We have quinquennial review. Ostensibly, the law says that we have to account for our tenure every 5 years, and it has to be satisfactory.
Or it will be revoked?
Yeah.
And how has that been implemented?
Very, very poorly. Very, very desultory.
Mm-hmm.
If people look at it and they think about it the way I thought about it, it's a stupidity. You cannot run a university on that basis.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you know, if I were trying to hire somebody from the University of Iowa,
mm-hmm,
and that person was thinking of coming instead to Wisconsin, I would tell him, look, in Iowa we have real tenure. And at Wisconsin, you really only have it for 5 years. And then you have to prove yourself again every 5 years. If you call that tenure, you could go to Wisconsin. Or you could come here to Iowa. We still have tenure.
And what was the position of the faculty here on that?
The position of the faculty was that they weren't going to win it and they weren't going to fight it.
And that came down from the Board of Regents, not from the legislature?
Actually, it came down from the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And through the Board of Regents, but we knew that the Board of Regents would accept that.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, have many tenured faculty lost their tenure status as a result of that?
No, I know of very few people who have lost their tenure status at all. And in most cases, in almost all of the cases, they have been at the state colleges.
I see.
But one case, which was there when I came back from the summer of 2000, was a professor from Superior who had been fired in a case which I consider just a classical case of employment at will.
Uh-huh. Oh yeah.
You know about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been fighting that now for 9.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not up to me to fight it.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the hands of the other local from the American Federation of Teachers. And it's being fought as a labor case. And I immediately said I would have fought it as a 14th Amendment case.
Mm-hmm.
Deprival of liberty and property without due process of law. There was no evidence against him.
Mm-hmm.
There was some talk against him. There was a drumbeat in the local press, which turns out to be a very powerful thing now.
Mm-hmm.
That if the local press has decided that a professor is a bad guy, that they can demand that he be fired, and they get be fired. We had a case here where I was the only one who would stand up for it, but I had to stand up for it.
Can you talk about that case?
I can talk about that case. This was a man that I knew just barely. He had been in the Department of Comparative Literature when my wife was in that department. And I would say that he was a sick man, and he was actually on psychiatric medication. Mm-hmm. And as I understood the case, he had been nagged to let his medication drop, that he didn't need it, by his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And he started behaving more and more erratically. And he had some kind of connection by computer with a 14-year-old boy in Milwaukee.
Oh, I remember this case. This is Cohen, right?
Cohen. And a policeman acting as the boy had arranged a meeting, and when he showed up for the meeting, he was arrested. Mm-hmm. The case went to trial. There were all kinds of charges against him, but the only one that was clearly proven was that he had misused the computer for an illegal contact with the boy. Mm-hmm. Other things people said, that they knew what he would do if he could do it. But there's no way of proving that. Mm-hmm. And the judge and the two lawyers came to an understanding of what they would do. And they would put him on probation for 2 years under the supervision of professionals, and he would be convicted of that charge, and that he would be on probation, and the probation would be satisfied not by the Wisconsin State Journal, but by these two people whose job it was to deal with this kind of a case. Mm-hmm. I saw that as being, you know, due process. Mm-hmm. The idea that a reporter can say, well, that may be the judge's belief, and the two lawyers, both lawyers, but they spoke about rehabilitating him as a professor. Mm-hmm. He had been here a long time, I forget exactly how long, and had no trouble in the university, and he attributed it all to his letting go of his medication. Mm-hmm. Which is believable. I mean, I take medication for my heart, and I find it tempting to let it go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
And a lot of people do that, mm-hmm. you know. Whatever it was, the university was determined to relieve themselves of this drumbeat from the Wisconsin State Journal, and they got rid of him.
But
I spoke against it. I said that the determination of the law was not only right, in my view, but it was the law. Mm-hmm. And they said that if they determined that he couldn't do his job, then they could fire him, in spite of the fact that there's a law against it.
Is this in the faculty senate?
This is in the faculty senate. I stood up and I spoke against the process, item by item by item. All kinds of people that I'm very close to, including those in the Committee on Academic Freedom and Rights, wouldn't touch it. They felt tainted by it. I felt tainted by it. But
they didn't stand with you because they agreed with the university's position?
I think they agreed with, but I think that they agreed under pressure.
I see.
I think that they were in a situation where, you know, essentially, if I may stretch a metaphor, this was a lynch mob.
Really?
Yeah, you tell people, look, this person's guilty. I don't care what the court says. He's guilty. He is a sexual predator, and if you leave him alone, he will do terrible things. It's not very different from the Emmett Till case in Mississippi, where they said, this boy winked at a white woman. If you leave him alone, he'll rape her.
I remember that case.
Yes, so that's why I say it's a lynch mob. I say, except that there was no rope involved. And furthermore, I think he wanted to lose. Because he went to see his counselor, and they said, well, you want to take a drug test. And he said, I don't want to give you a drug test. And I said, why not? He says, because I smoked a joint last night. Oh. Okay? This was a man who was living on the edge of a precipice. Mm-hmm. Okay? And he's telling these people, you know, I think he was happy finally to go home to Washington, D.C.
Oh, I see. So he was then fired by the university.
He was fired by the university, and a year later, he appealed to be able to go home and be sick there. And they said to him, or at least this is what he said to me, I don't know that it's true. They said, if you will leave today, get on the airplane today for Washington, we will agree with that, otherwise not. He had a house, an apartment house actually, and a car, and all his properties here. He just got on the plane and left. The point is, I could not say that I was on his side. I was on the side of the law. Mm-hmm. I thought that the law had made a decent, generous agreement that if taking his medicines would keep him straight, he could continue and be a professor. You know, I know that in the 60s and 70s, I had colleagues here who were screwing every undergraduate that they could get their hands on. Mm-hmm. You know, this was, but there it was. I mean, it was because it was a cause celebre. So I stood up and spoke, and I felt very uncomfortable doing it. But I knew I had to speak up because nobody else would.
Now, did you take a lot of criticism for that, for defending Professor Cohen? I remember it was in the, not about you, but I now remember the case was in the papers a lot.
Right. And most people didn't talk to me about it. I didn't get any resonance. Okay?
Repercussions?
No, I don't think so. Most people didn't talk to me about it. The only repercussion that I got, which cost me very heavily, was that the chairman of comparative literature was a woman that I considered a close friend. And I haven't had any contact with her since that time. She was a professor of classical languages. And in the meantime, that department has been dissolved. Mm-hmm. It was in terrible trouble when my wife was in it. And there were terrible things in it. One of my friends You need to change things?
No, we're fine.
One of my friends, whom I refer to in another unpublished manuscript of mine, as Dr. Richard Jacobson. He's one of the smartest people I know. Very erudite, very, very well informed, very interesting in the field of language. And he was in the Department of Comparative Literature, but he did not know how to keep his mouth shut, and he was denied tenure. And then he went out and he became a lawyer.
Oh, doctor.
Yeah. And I also refer to him as ex-assistant professor Jacobson, because I don't know if you know the reference, ex-private first class somebody or other in Catch 22.
Oh, right. Yes.
Well, I was in 1986, I was trying to defend an assistant professor who had been denied tenure. And he had been denied tenure under conditions that I consider scandalous. And at one point, I brought in Richard as a lawyer to look into this case. But at any rate, he was fired. John Brankman was also denied tenure. He had been on a greased path for tenure until in 1970. Was it 1980?
I think it was 1980.
1980. He declared that he was on the side of the striking TAs. And then all of a sudden the dean sent his thing out for review by somebody in New York who said don't hire him, so he didn't.
Oh yes, I've heard about this case, Dean Cronin.
Dean Cronin.
And Brinkman was in?
Comparative Literature.
Oh, was he? He was in.
Yeah, that's the point. I'm telling you, this is a department. I mean, Richard Jacobson sort of had Cronin over the barrel. He finally made a deal with Cronin that he would work half-time as an academic staff member while getting his law degree. And the reason...
Here at the UW?
Yeah. And the reason was because he had one of these things on which he had a member of that department say, this is almost verbatim, he said, "Mr. Jacobson, you are not a thoroughgoing Marxist, and because you are not a thoroughgoing Marxist, I will vote against your tenure." He actually said that. He could see the thing sitting right on the table. Mm-hmm. Jacobson said, "I'm the only person who has proof that he was denied tenure at Wisconsin partially because he was not a communist." So that was a department in very serious trouble. Mm-hmm. But the head of the department at the time of the Cohen matter, mm-hmm, was somebody that I like very much.
Was that Mary Lou?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And I consider her a close friend, but she hasn't spoken to me in all this time.
Since you defended Cohen in the right. Faculty Senate.
Right, because I had to attack the position of the department.
Mm-hmm. Anatole, when did the Faculty Senate come into existence?
I can tell you that. It was already beginning to come into existence when I was in the university committee. Mm-hmm. And what I expected of it actually happened. It was supposed to supplant the Young Turks by the silent majority. And I said, I know what will happen. It will become a dull chore that nobody wants to do and will pass all the power to the administration. There will be people coming there who have no interest, like the people who didn't come to the medical school thing, mm-hmm. when the agriculture school thing. Those people, they don't want to be bothered with that. Oh, what, somebody has to be a senator? So it has to be me this time? All right, I'll do it. Mm-hmm. I, on the other hand, have taken that as a mission.
To
be a senator. Mostly I say nothing. Most of the business is just boring as hell. Mm-hmm. Nobody really cares. Okay? But then there are things that come up. Just 12 months ago, I had a victory. I got the Faculty Senate to vote for changing the name of Campus Drive to Carl Link Drive. You know about Carl Link.
I do.
Okay. And it's now been refused by the city, and I expect that to come up next week. And it had been I had gotten such a vote 10 years earlier, and the city objected then on the same basis, and I've decided I will fight it. I can't fight it this month, I can't fight it in October, but I can get up and announce in October that I will be fighting it in November. And if somebody has an objection to Carl Link, I expect to hear from him, or he should forever hold his peace.
Mm-hmm. I have been told that the primary reason for the creation of the Senate was because the faculty had grown too large, that it was unmanageable.
No, it was unmanageable, but the people that it was unmanageable about were people, very surprising people. People like David Feldman, whom I have the highest regard up to that point. I mean, he is one of the authors of tenure in the United States. I have great respect for his memory, but by the time that the Brinkman case came up, he said of the committee that was hearing this case that they mustn't insult the dean. The dean is an important person, and you cannot insult him by saying he was wrong. He said this to me. He didn't say this publicly. I went to see him about that. Okay? And, what's her name? Helen White was an activist in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And Edwin Young was one of the people who founded Local 223. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there were all of these people, but by the time we're talking about the 70s and 80s, the power center in the university were the longtime friends of these people. And they felt that the faculty meeting had gotten out of hand, especially with the Vietnam protest. Uh-huh. But not only the Vietnam protest, as I said, the denial of the honorary doctorate to Martin Luther King, uh-huh. I considered scandalous. Uh-huh. I mean, he wasn't yet a saint, mm-hmm. but by now he's a saint. Mm-hmm. So in a certain sense, I was right and David Feldman was wrong. Mm-hmm. The fact that he was inconvenient to the Milwaukee authorities is not enough to have denied him that honor, mm-hmm. in my view. But, these things change, and the faculty's meeting was unmanageable because people who had an axe to grind would show up. So it became a self-selected senate.
I see.
So these were people who were turning, this is my analysis and I'll stand by it, they were turning to the silent majority to take power out of the faculty senate, out of the faculty meeting. But I knew that they were taking power out of the faculty.
Mm-hmm. And do you date the decline of the power of the faculty to the decision to create the faculty senate?
That was part of it. Another part of it is that's a national movement. Every college in the country is attacking tenure and academic freedom.
Let me just conclude this. This now concludes the September 28th, 2009 session with Professor Anatole Beck.